Welcome to the first episode of Onward, a Fundrise podcast. This is the place where we talk about what's happening at Fundrise, our real estate investing platform, as well as the news and trends bubbling up in the real estate world and the economy that matter. We wanted to create this podcast to give you, the investor, a direct line into Fundrise strategy and performance. I'm Emily Peck, content director at Fundrise and a longtime podcast host. Today, I'm delighted to be here with Ben Miller, Fundrise's co-founder and CEO, and significantly, the co-host of this year's podcast. Ben, welcome.
Hey, Emily, this should be exciting.
To kick off our inaugural episode, Ben, I wanted to talk to you about third quarter performance. Some investors might have already gotten the letter that we sent out to investors where we highlighted quarter of remarkable results. Some investments in the third quarter saw price appreciation of more than 50%. All told, I believe the strongest performance we've ever experienced. So exceptional, in fact, that we sent out the letter in the first place, because typically you guys don't even send out a Q3 letter. Typically you wait till end of year. So I guess my first question for you is, what happened? What's the story behind the good news?
Yeah, overnight success, years in the making. I feel like all success actually works that way. You don't really notice until they're successful. We've been working on a few investment strategies for years, and those strategies were exactly the right strategies for what ended up playing out over the last couple of years. There were a handful of macro trends we've been focused on investing into for a number of years, and the pandemic accelerated those macro trends. Those were people moving to the Sun Belt, a technological driver of how people wanted to live, and in particular, a demographic driver of rising millennial class of people who are having kids and eventually were going to move from that 600 square foot apartment. Those trends basically came together during the last 12 months to drive real estate prices in a way that nobody expected, but like all trends were years in the making.
I want to talk about each of these trends. I think we should just like dig into each one. So let's start with the Sun Belt. We started investing in the Sun Belt in 2015. First, I guess, tell people what the Sun Belt actually is and why did you decide to invest more heavily in 2015 in that region? And then what happened in the pandemic that made it soar?
So I don't think that there's some uniform definition of it. Basically, from Virginia south down the coast to Florida, and around the coast to Texas, and then like to Arizona. And some people might include some Southern California and Nevada, but it's generally cities and states with much better weather, much lower cost of living, lower tax sort of regime. And there's been net migration to these parts of the country for decades. I think key to it is just looking at the price differential between like a San Francisco and an Austin.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a slope water will just flow in the direction of the slope. And that slope, that gradient is steep between like a New York and a Florida or a San Francisco and an Austin. It draws people in that direction. We've been thinking about that and investing into that theme for at least 5, 6, 7 years.
And in the pandemic, when people became like untethered from place, we didn't need to go to the office anymore. That whole trend accelerated a ton.
Right. And so when lots of people move someplace, there's no more housing, right? So the demand increased, but the supply didn't. And so demand increased rapidly, and I think somewhat permanently. And actually, one of the things about trends is they compound. There's lots of ways to think about it. But one way is, okay, Emily's best friend moves to Austin or Raleigh. And now all of a sudden, it's not just that it's more affordable and that it's got good weather, but now your friend lives there. So there's a compounding effect. And Emily moves down there. And now two of your friends live down there. And also like a coffee shop opens up because people who used to live in Westchester now live in Austin. And so then there's a cultural compounding effect. And then the companies move there because there's people and culture and affordability. So the compounding effects of this change are accelerating. And I think we're underestimated.
And because more people did it in the pandemic, that's not a trend that's going to end once the restrictions of COVID are totally lifted, but it's just going to keep going because now a lot of people live there. So more people are going to want to live there and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, that's one of the ways it compounds. I mean, there's so many other ways. Remote technology is another part of that, right? So you've compounding social dynamics, compounding cultural dynamics, compounding economic dynamics, compounding technology dynamics. All of those things are interacting together.
Okay, so to just go back to the original question, what were the trends that drove the Q3 performance? The first one you mentioned was the Sun Belt. The second one you wanted to mention was e-commerce and technology, because more people were working from home, shopping online, blah, 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 blah. They didn't need to be in a small apartment in a big city anymore.
Right. Well, so they were forced home by the pandemic and they adopted remote technology. So now they're at home all day. And you're like, okay, well, if you're going to be at home all day, do you want to be in a studio apartment, you know, very little light, no space? And so all of a sudden, what you were looking for from your like living experience totally changed, right? It became also your office. You stayed home a lot more for so many reasons. And so you now ask a lot more of your home. And I mean, like apartments in New York were basically designed for you just to sleep in and spend no time there.
What you're saying is so interesting because it speaks to why the value of residential real estate would increase. The value of your home to a homeowner, a home renter, and we'll get into single family rentals, the value is really increasing to you, like not just the price of it, but just the actual value. You're using it a lot more. You're using it for new and different things. It's kind of like revolutionary to think about it in that way, actually.
Yeah, the utility of it, if you wanted to get like an economic term. So another way we think about it is, you know, Fundrise's investment platform. We also have our technology platform. We have a million members. We have apps. We build software, investor experiences. Like, it's a consumer product. Real estate is a consumer product too. Most investors in real estate are financial engineers. They're not consumer designers. They don't think about the consumer product experience of the real estate. They think about it as primarily a financial asset.
Okay.
But its financial returns are a derivative of its consumer value.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about that before. And in the next half of the podcast, I want to talk about just like the general real estate boom. But I feel like that's a very powerful way of thinking about our returns and the real estate market more generally, just that what homes mean to people really has like radically shifted over the past 18 plus months. So talk about how Fundrise sort of was able to leverage that shift. I know that single family rentals is a sector that sort of exploded.
We were one step ahead on that one. And we were out trying to basically build homes for rent in these regions back in 2019. Originally, we called it horizontal multifamily.
Okay.
Because we were saying people want to rent, but they don't want to live stacked up. They want to live with like backyards and space. And we thought of it as like little cottages. There were like two companies in the country building it.
Building single family homes to rent out.
To rent in like communities. And there's like a pool and a clubhouse and lush landscaping. It's a product experience, not just a house. The only place this was really happening was in Phoenix. There are two developers. They both claim they invented it. They used to work together and they separated.
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a whole background.
Kind of juicy drama there.
Yeah, yeah. And they and they have sort of different debates about like how you design it and what it looks like and what do people want. People think of real estate as a product like you'd think of an iPhone or like a shirt, but it's actually a product that's made. And like some things people want to buy and some things people don't want to buy. And it matters. The construction of it, the design of it matters. And so these guys invented a new kind of real estate. So anyways, we saw this trend. We thought it was phenomenal. We wanted to invest into it. This is the future. Like, I don't, my dad would say this to me, when the Beatles went on the Ed Sullivan show, people were like, this is the future of music, right? If you're a real estate nerd like me and you see something, you're like, oh, this is the future of housing.
What led you to have that insight?
We thought about this idea. We went out looking for someone who was doing it. And then we found people doing it. And like, you know, a lot of ideas, a few people had it at once. They were doing it way before we thought of it. Our team is a lot of relatively young people, probably a lot of people in their 30s, maybe late 20s. They're all having kids. I had two kids a while ago, two kids who were, I was living in an 800 square foot apartment. I had two kids in one room. They could reach across the cribs and like touch fingers. It was tight. And I was like, I've got to get out of this small space.
This is very relatable.
Yeah, totally, right? And that's what I mean by real estate's a consumer product. Because I was sitting there consuming a product meant for a single person in the city. And I had to, I mean, I don't even go to restaurants anymore. I just spent my time as a parent. And I just needed a different product experience from my real estate. And we saw all these people, all these millennials, basically going in that direction. I'm saying, wait a second, like the real estate industry spent from 2010 to 2018 just producing housing for millennials who were single. That was a mega trend we were early invested into before that, which was 2010, 2016 when we transitioned. But that was when and those single millennials wanted to live in Bushwick and Brooklyn and LA Arts District. And that was a great way to invest. And basically, we just followed that consumer to the next thing they wanted.
So normally, when you think about older than millennial generations that are in your situation, stuck in the tiny apartment with the babies touching fingers across the cribs, they go buy a house. So what made you think these guys don't want to buy houses, they want to rent them? Because that seems like the key insight and the key difference.
So if you go look at the demographics, you can see there's waves. There's like a wave of baby boomers. It's called a boom, baby boomers. There's a huge number of people that are born from a certain period, and then all of them reach a certain age at a certain time and affect the culture and economics. They would cause, in the 70s, the baby boomers caused tons of inflation. There was just massive number of people coming in, increasing demand, consumption. And then the millennials is an echo boom. It's actually more millennials. And you could see, like, literally, this is how many people will be 23 in 2019. I mean, you can look out decades and see it coming. So, 3 million more people will be graduating from college and entering the workforce than was the case like 7 years ago. It blows me away that real estate people are like, whoa, where do these people come from? Like, all these people want to rent my apartments in, you know, downtown, whatever, Brooklyn. Like, who would have thought that? And it's, I mean, real estate's like primarily, I mean, it's basically driven by demographics and like monetary policy. So like our team, mostly millennial team, I'm an outlier, I'm a Gen Xer, I'm the cynical one. That's us, right? I think you're an Xer too, Emily, right?
Proud Gen Xer. Don't erase us.
Apathetic and cynical.
All right.
No? I thought that was our rap.
Fine. I'll take it.
Yeah, that was such an apathetic response.
Oh my God. Anyway, do you want to tell listeners more about how Fundrise systematically identifies these kinds of trends?
So a lot of the things that we do, any great investor would do, right? You would say, okay, let's look at data. We have technology data and we have market data. And you basically look at these mega trends. But it is not that complicated, looking at demographics, looking at job growth, looking at what the basic drivers are. I think it's actually very intuitive. And if you go back to the 80s, Peter Lynch was the popularizer of mutual funds and basically became the sort of like face of the industry. He would always just say, like, invest in companies that you love their products. Like, if you, back in 09, you love the iPhone, you think it's an incredible product, you should be buying Apple shares. And that's so true. But the investment professional, the financial professional, wants you to feel like you can't do the work without them.
Okay.
The investment professional says, this is actually really complicated. It requires a lot of sophistication. You're going to have to pay me a lot of money. There's a lot of jargon. I happen to invent the jargon, but you know, you need me to understand it.
That is my favorite point about the financial jargon. And there's this industry line where it's like people need financial education to understand financial jargon that we invented.
So much of what Fundrise is about is pulling back the curtain on what actually is happening and just owning it. The math of finance is so simple.
What do you mean?
Because I sit in a company with a lot of MBA, you know, really smart financial engineers who they have Excel spreadsheets that are 100 pages long. It's multiplication, division, addition, subtraction.
I'm familiar with those terms.
Right. If you go across the office to the engineers, they're doing calculus. They're doing one-way functions. They're doing rainbow tables. Off the charts math, I have no idea what they're talking about. I sit there, I'm like, help me understand these algorithms. I have no idea what they're talking about. I can't, literally, it hurts my brain. I tried, I love spending time with them. But like, that's not finance. There's so little really complicated math in finance. But the idea is somehow that finance is sophisticated from a math point of view. And it's just not.
All right, well,
We have digressed.
My brain hurts. Oh, I had asked you, was there something special we were doing
systematic
to identify the trends? Is it part math, part feeling?
I don't think it's that complicated. We recognize Build for Rent. We're like, this is a better mousetrap. It's a better product at half the price. of an apartment. There's 138 million apartment units in the country, and there's basically none of this. There's no supply of it. And I was like, this is better. This is basically what people are going to want, and you can't even get it. So the supply-demand dynamics seem really attractive to me. And so that means that probably it's going to have good pricing, good occupancy, like good investment parameters around it. So that was like the essence of it. You understand the supply, you understand demand, you understand essentially the context. And that's how we got to build for rent.
Can you put a number on what percentage of Funmer's our investments are in build for rent and SFR right now?
Probably a third to a half, depending on what your exact definition of build for rent is.
And it's become a really competitive space. I think the week that we're recording this, I think the Wall Street Journal had a piece on how popular the sector has become, with really big players getting involved and bidding up the price a little bit. Do you see this as a bubble, or what stage are we in the SFR timeline, would you say?
It's like first inning. It's so early on this trend. Okay. It's supply constrained. There's just not enough supply, and that's causing like pricing challenges. But like from a math point of view, to build an apartment in New York costs more than $1,000 a square foot. To build an apartment in Dallas costs $250 a square foot. Probably now with supply chain issues, getting $300 a square foot. And to build a house, build for rent house costs $150 a square foot.
Wow.
So if the price goes up by 10%, it's $165 a square foot.
So why are millennials different? Why aren't they looking to buy houses? Why do they want to rent them?
I think they are looking to buy houses. I mean, there's just so many. There's tens of millions, 80-some million millennials. You're not going to build 80 million homes overnight. So there are not enough homes to buy. That's part of it. And probably the biggest part of it is affordability. And you can rent a house, you know, the houses we build and rent, you know, $1,200 a month for four bedrooms, five bedrooms, you know, three baths, like backyard. I mean, it's so affordable. And then there's also a cultural shift, which is the whole sharing economy movement. Like a lot of people are like, well, why do I want to own? I mean, I'm a renter by choice. Like everything broke in the last 6 months in that house. I mean, everything, like dishwasher, the stove, the roof had a hole in it. There was a flood and it cost the owner like a fortune. It was horrible. And I just was like, well, it's not my problem.
That does sound nice.
It was so great.
Not to worry about it. To be clear, listeners, Funrise is not an investor in that house.
Yes. I don't live in a Funrise owned house. Not that lucky.
So I think that there's also like a different expectation among kind of rising generations around ownership and around kind of what matters to them. In a remote technology world, mobility matters a lot more. And so you may not want to buy a home and live there for 30 years. You may want to live someplace for 3 months, 12 months. And so there's a lot of reasons, but the way that like a boomer thought about how they would live is just not the same. Music changed and movie taste changed and literature changed. Of course, like how you live and what you live in will change too.
Well, one thing I wanted to hear you talk about, and that I think maybe is on a lot of people's mind, is just, I mean, we have seen enormous growth in real estate prices. It does seem like a real estate boom right now. And I know things have started to slow down a bit. How are you thinking about that? I think of it as just like a normal person. I saw bidding wars going on. My neighbor is selling his house. He put it on the market some like crazy price, but it's just sitting there. Price keeps coming down. So I'm wondering, like, give me your big picture thoughts on the boom and what's going on.
Yeah, I have to parse that.
Parse away.
Let me parse it in a few different ways. So people conflate home buying and selling with all real estate.
Mm-hmm.
They're connected, but they definitely have different dynamics going on. And then also the nature of any price dynamic is that it always overshoots. And so people saw the price increase. Some people grabbed it and they kept going. And at some point, like by its nature, it would overshoot. And what happened, in my opinion, was that the price increased because of demand, not because it changed supply.
Mm-hmm.
And that demand was like temporary. It wasn't going to be 10 years of people moving to Westchester.
No.
It was 12 months of people moving from Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it was a temporary trend that people wanted to believe was a more permanent trend of growth, of price increases. And that happens all the time in markets. Demand for housing started to come down, but the supply never changed. That's why prices went up so fast and started to come down so quickly. It was just so obviously a wave.
It's like a certain number of people were going to move, and then that's it. It's not the same trend you were talking about earlier with the Sun Belt where it's compounding. Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Ben, is just to dig in a little on what I think has become the biggest real estate story I'm seeing in the news the past few weeks, and that's Zillow. and iBuying. So for people who haven't been following this, basically Zillow, the real estate website, had this initiative called iBuying where they went out and bought people's houses, fixed them up and flipped them. And they really accelerated that program in the pandemic. And then suddenly in October, they announced they were slowing it down. And then in early November, Zillow said, we're not doing iBuying anymore. It's losing money. The company was apparently underwater on a lot of the houses it was selling. Patrick Clark has a quote, the reporter in Bloomberg, he says, the episode is a cautionary tale for what happens when an overconfident company uses algorithms to supersize an old-fashioned business. And so I kind of just wanted to ask you about this because I'm interested in how Fundrise is different from iBuying and just like what you think of that business overall and what happened.
Yeah. Wow. There's so many actual questions in that. So first, what Zillow was trying to do was essentially get rid of home brokers where you would buy and sell your home through the internet rather than buying and selling your home through a home broker. And the way they were trying to backdoor into that was by basically financing the transaction, essentially by buying and selling the home themselves so that you would ultimately get everybody to adopt your platforms, how you would sell homes or buy homes. So it wasn't a financial investment. It was trying to basically move the home transaction to an online marketplace, essentially. What we're doing when we build and rent homes is nothing to do with what Zillow is doing.
Okay.
Which they made a separate mistake, which is that they were buying so many homes, I think they made like 8,000 homes a quarter or something like that. And they were using algorithms to buy them. And that was also a mistake. This idea in finance, it's like a dream of the financial professional to use software to like make better buy decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's like algorithms. And basically, I think in real estate, that's going to be very unlikely. I'm a big skeptic of that idea. It's what the financial professional dreams of because it makes them like even more important to the buy.
Yeah.
And creates like a secret sauce. But it's not actually really what's happening in real estate, especially large macro real estate driven trends. Basically, any great economist will tell you that you can't actually forecast macro trend changes. Nobody in January 2020 would have saw the pandemic and been able to forecast that. Your algorithm would have gotten destroyed. And coming out of the pandemic, Zillow's algorithm got destroyed again. So where you see algorithms in finance is in short-term trends, like high-frequency trading on picoseconds or microseconds. Real estate is multi-year trends. It doesn't lend itself to algorithms for a long time. And so I think Zillow made a kind of tactical mistake in their effort to try to create an online platform for home buying.
It reminds me of what you were saying before, that it's part math and part feeling. In real estate, because the assets are such particular kinds of products, you can't just leave it to a computer program to make your investment decisions.
Right. I mean, here's one that's so like obvious now in retrospect, but literally people did not see it coming. Is it like back in 2003 or 2004, they were building more retail than you could possibly believe. Like more retail was built from 2003 to 2007 than like maybe ever.
Oh, and boy.
Right? And e-commerce and Amazon was like, it was clearly a trend that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So why would you have e-commerce, like the birth of e-commerce and the rise of Amazon from 2000 to 2007, at the same time, more retail getting built than ever before? Would an algorithm have told you that Amazon was going to destroy you? So that's the kind of stuff where it's pretty obvious, intuitive from a consumer's point of view, but the financial industry will constantly miss this type of trend dynamic.
Everyone is talking about inflation right now. The CPI rose 6.2% in October, fastest inflation in 31 years. How does that shift your outlook on Fundrise's investing strategies?
So, I mean, inflation, it sounds so boring, but it's actually one of the biggest drivers of change in our society. So, the United States and actually the world's gone through two inflationary periods from like post-World War II till the end of the 70s. It was a inflationary period where inflation ended up, I mean, like my father talks about, you know, getting home loans, 22% interest rate.
Ah.
That was normal interest rate people would pay in like 1980. And there was really high unemployment, like almost double digit. I don't even know what credit card debt would have cost. Can't even imagine. And then we went through a deflationary period where inflation fell from like 1981 to 2020. And it kept falling and people couldn't believe it, especially people who lived through the high inflation periods of the 70s. And I think that we hit the turning point during the pandemic, and that previous period from 81 to 2020 ended. and we're starting a new, whole new epoch. It's hard to, and you know, you can't exactly know what it's going to be like, but I don't think it's going to be deflationary in the same way. And so we're going to see a lot more inflation than we're used to. The credit markets, which are like this $100 trillion plus dollar market, hasn't yet recognized how significant and permanent, or at least long-term, this inflationary trend is. But when you talk about sort of why is it more permanent than I think people appreciate, but the point is inflation drives real estate prices up. So, I mean, it's super simple, right? There's more dollars, but I mean, real estate's a real asset, and obviously money is not. So they call it the quantity of money theory. More money, but same amount of real estate, so there's basically the price of real estate goes up. So inflation has been really good for real asset prices, and I think that's basically a pressure, like an ambient pressure lifting real estate returns, and will lift it for the next number of years.
So in other words, prices are going up for everything. Real estate prices are going up as much or even more?
For some real estate, even more, because it's not like everything's equal across the country. You know, Youngstown is not like Austin. And so there'll be more inflation where there's more demand. And so there's more demand in the Sun Belt and, you know, Austin being a great example. And then just like the thing that's really like unbelievably good for returns in the short term is that the interest rates are still in the old period. And we're still borrowing at 1.75%. The real estate that our investors are invested into, our borrowing rates is still like super low, 2%. And so inflation, 6%. So you're borrowing at a negative interest rate. Like literally the bank's paying you effectively. It's a little hard to imagine, right? But if interest rates are 3% that we're borrowing on and inflation 6%, the bank lost 3% that year. And we gained it basically in rents and asset appreciation. So there's both inflation driving overall prices and like this like levered returns happening, which is actually that happened before. That's the funny thing. This is like 1971, there was the same dynamic. It's what caused inflation to get so crazy because they had basically a monetary policy that was inflationary during inflation, which is what's happening today. And they also did fiscal stimulus in 1971. They pumped the money. So you had government spending, Federal Reserve basically like pumping the economy with low interest rates. Literally, the Federal Reserve is still buying bonds, quantitative easing, and there's inflation. So we're just like, at this point, like nothing deflationary happening. Everything's inflationary. And that's, I think, going to have like huge effects on all prices, real estate returns are going to see this, you know, positive pressure. It's going to be disruptive as well overall on like how the economy works, but opportunity to basically invest well.
That's really interesting, Ben, but it's also freaking me out. I want to, in this last segment, bring up a question from the listeners. Since this is our first episode, we do not have listener questions, but we do have investor questions because, Ben, you did a Reddit AMA, Ask Me Anything, a few weeks ago. And the question I wanted to ask you from that AMA is sort of related to what you're talking about now with retail. And the question was, should we expect the majority of investments to be residential in the next 2 to 3 years at Fundrise, or do you see opportunities in commercial? Will real estate and office be challenged over the short term?
I am very concerned about office and retail investment. If retail has been depreciating for the last 20 years, and the institutional combine has been like not marking it down because they don't want to take the losses, somehow hoping it was a temporary trend. And so they'll hold on. And that's happening with office now, too. There's sort of like a denial. And that's going to basically take a long time. Even now, retail, if you wanted to go buy a mall, essentially is dead. It still might not be priced as basically like land for teardown, right? So it's going to take a really long time for the industry to reprice all of those assets where you would basically say, oh, okay, now I can buy that office building and turn it into apartments. The amount of money people are going to lose in that transition is like $1 trillion.
And this is because companies don't need as many people working in offices anymore, but we're still in a limbo state right now where those offices are still around. You're talking to me from the Fundrise office and I am not there.
Nobody's here but me. Yeah, right. I mean, it's whether it's retail or office or actually inflation, people are reluctant to give up the old trends for a lot of reasons. And as a result, the prices will lag. I don't think it's a good area to invest in broadly. So we've been focused on residential, different kinds of residential, different kinds of e-commerce, industrial, logistic. There are some other interesting trends. There's like a clear growth trend around streaming videos. There's more and more content production, and there's not enough real estate for it. That's like an interesting real estate play. We own a building that's a studio in Los Angeles. You Think You Can Dance, like his film there. You know that with Jennifer Lopez and Snap.
Ben just did a little like dancing thing with his head.
Yeah.
Listeners should know.
I shouldn't have done that.
On that note, that's it for our very first episode. That was really fun. Thanks, Ben.
So fun. Look forward to the next time. Onward.
Again, I'm your host, Emily Peck. I was here with Ben Miller, our CEO and co-host. Thank you so much for listening. Please send your comments and questions to onward@funrise.com. And if you like what you heard, please rate us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. This here podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did our music, and executive produced by me, Emily Peck, with help from Will Gurney. Bye.